Hi, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's March 2025, and this is episode 435, which is a conversation about the scientific community, who is widely regarded in our culture as the ultimate authority on truth about the world, and how, in particular, philosophical naturalists explain and pursue human significance and meaning in what they see as a godless universe. Today's guest is Dr. Melissa Kane Travis. I'm excited to have her back on the podcast. It's been several years since she's been on, and Melissa is a fellow of Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. She is also the author of Thinking God's Thoughts and Science and the Mind of the Maker. Melissa has written an exclusive online feature article called The Pathos of the Reflective Naturalist: Meaning, Happiness, and Eternity in Our Hearts. And you can read it without a paywall for free on equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. Melissa, it's been a while since you've been on the podcast, but I'm very excited for this conversation today and to welcome you back.
Thank you. I'm always excited to talk with you. This is one of my favorite outlets for writing and podcasting. So I'm happy that I had a chance to contribute something new and that we get to talk about it.
Well, this is a topic that is of interest, I think, to a lot of people. So I definitely want our listeners to hang in there, because the idea of pursuing happiness is something that is just like almost one of those things that is essential to people's understanding who they are, especially people who are not religious. So if you ask a lot of people who are not religious about, like, what are your hopes for your kids as they're being launched into the world, like going to college, what I hear from those folks is, well, the most important thing is that my child is happy, or that I'm happy, or what does it mean to pursue happiness? So this is a very fascinating topic. It will be a little bit of a intellectual kind of thinking cap way that we're going to talk about it, but I think it's very important because it is something that people care about deeply. So this is just, I mean, all people, whether they're Christians or, like I said, non-religious, they care about having meaning in their life. What does it mean to exist? So how about you? When did you first become interested in this particular issue of the problem of meaning?
Well, I started graduate school at Biola University back in 2009, and I took an introductory apologetics class during that first semester. And one of the lectures I was required to listen to was one that was given by William Lane Craig decades ago. And the title of the lecture was The Absurdity of Life Without God. And still to this day, I rank that lecture as one of the top three most influential lectures of my academic life, because it got me thinking about meaning in a whole new way. And so throughout his lecture, he actually gets very interdisciplinary. He talks about various literary art, etc. He talks about the philosophical problems with meaning if God does not exist. And that led me down a wonderful rabbit hole. And I developed an interest in existentialist philosophy and in the nihilistic literary art that actually demonstrates through imaginative writing this tragic absurdity of life that we have to face if there is nothing that transcends the material universe. So one example of that would be Samuel Beckett's work. I'm sure listeners have come across Beckett's work in high school English class before, but he was famous for stage plays that demonstrate this tragic absurdity of life, as I put it. One of the examples that I like to use in a classroom is a play that Beckett wrote called Breathe. And I won't spoil it for listeners, but I would encourage you to go on YouTube. There are several different videos that show different interpretations of that play, but it's a really good example of art communicating this idea of the absurdity of life, of the nihilism that we're left with if there's nothing outside the material world. And then we also see hints of the idea in science fiction literature. This is probably my favorite place to go for classroom examples. H.G. Wells is a good example. And for anybody that's interested, I actually wrote a reflection on H.G. Wells' famous novella, The Time Machine, where I discuss how that particular novella reflects what I'm talking about. You can find that essay over at the Worldview Bulletin. The title of it is The Noble Lie of Poetic Naturalism. But since I do a lot of work within the discipline of science and religion, this problem of meaning has hit my radar in some really exciting new ways over the past several years, because we've seen this wave of literature coming out from these highly credentialed scientists in which they're actually talking about these deep philosophical problems of life. And I talk about these in some other places. I've written about them actually for Christian Research Journal. So listeners who have read some of my other articles or heard some of my other podcasts, this is going to ring a bell. So we have guys like Sean Carroll, Brian Greene, and Neil deGrasse Tyson. Sean Carroll wrote a book back in 2016 called The Big Picture on the Origins of Life, Meaning, and the Universe Itself. Brian Greene in 2020 wrote a book called Until the End of Time, Mind, Matter, and Our Search for Meaning in an Evolving Universe. And then Neil deGrasse Tyson has several video shorts that you can find online where he's answering listeners and readers' questions about purpose and meaning in life. And then he has a short book that came out several years ago called Letters from an Astrophysicist. And one of the letters that he answers in that book is a letter in which one of his fans is asking him, well, what is the meaning of life given what we know about the universe? So all of this to say, I've had, I guess, 15, 16 years of thinking about this meaning problem and really discovering how rich this conversation is, how interdisciplinary it is. And I'm just increasingly excited about it. It's not something I ever get tired of reading about, researching, and writing about.
Well, this is really interesting, you know, because it's something that scholars, you know, non-religious scholars are thinking about too, and other public intellectuals, you know, and they're having this phrase that they're talking about called the meaning crisis. And I want you to kind of explain to our listeners what that is and why Christians should care. You know, as a matter of fact, as I was preparing for this podcast, I stumbled upon a professor who has a PhD, I think it's psychology and cognitive science, and he's a Buddhist. And he has an entire series called Awakening from the Meaning Crisis. And it's a 50-part lecture series about, you know, how this has helped, you know, why this matters for your mental health from his point of view. So this is something that people are really talking about. I mean, if somebody's, you know, online giving 50 lectures on this. So explain to us a little bit more about what this is and why Christians should take note of it, really.
Oh, yeah. So the guy that you're talking about, he's at the University of Toronto. His name is John Vervaeke.
Yes, exactly. That's him.
Yeah. So he, I believe, coined this term meaning crisis. And if you go on YouTube, as you said, you can find a whole lecture series that he did about this. So we have to kind of back up a step. So the meaning crisis is directly related to what many are recognizing as our contemporary mental health crisis. So we're seeing statistical spikes in suicide rates, epidemics of loneliness, anxiety, and depression. We're seeing more and more expressions of nihilism and frustration with what seems like the futility of life.
So John, a loneliness crisis, I would point out, and I will tell our listeners, we have a in-depth article on that, but that's even reached like governmental levels of countries where they're caring about this.
Yeah, for sure. And so John Vervaeke attributes the mental health crisis to what he calls the meaning crisis. He says, we're all desperately hungry for a sense of deep meaningfulness. And this current cultural moment in which we find ourselves feels like this big, dark sea of meaninglessness in which we're all drowning. We're just flailing around in all this noise. And so identifying truth and purpose and meaning has come to seem impossible. And so guys like Verveke say, well, fundamentally what we need is wisdom. We need to start cultivating wisdom in our lives very intentionally. So Verveke has a foundation called the Verveke Foundation. And if you go to their website, the slogan is, wisdom is not optional, which is just so interesting because, as you said, he's not a Christian, he's a Buddhist. So guys like Verveke, they think we can retrieve the wisdom of ancient thinkers, of ancient philosophers, like the Stoics, for example, and we can incorporate that wisdom into our lives. And by doing that collectively, we can create a cultural revolution that helps us as a broader society deal with and hopefully overcome the meaning crisis. And I'm sure our listeners have noticed, if they're observant at all, what's referred to as the mindfulness revolution. So this would be related. The mindfulness revolution is essentially the intersection of cognitive science and a lot of Eastern religious practices. And the idea is that you can become happier and more mentally healthy through practices like meditation, connecting with nature, and then by doing things to cultivate meaningfulness in your life. So when advocates of mindfulness talk about wisdom, they're using that word in a similar sense to what Verveke and his followers are doing. It's very much wisdom in a non-theistic sense. But the problem is you can't get authentic meaning without a transcendent source of objective meaning. And that's something that I emphasize in this article. And as Christians, I think it's important that we acknowledge that the apologetics landscape is changing such that this topic of meaning is really becoming center stage. And I think that's precisely because of the exploding mental health crisis. And so that means that we need to equip ourselves to have conversations about meaning with the non-believers in our lives. And just as a side note, Justin Brierley's recent book, The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, is helpful on this topic in some ways because he talks about this shift in the apologetics landscape, and he gives some real life accounts of how this meaning crisis has actually led several high profile secular thinkers to reconsider God and Christianity. And I think we need to take a cue from this. I think it's an important area of emphasis, and that's why I'm excited about continuing to research and write about it.
I think that the best publicity we have for this podcast is you. We appreciate how you're telling people about the podcast and getting the word out. And here's what we've got coming up for different points this year. And also, we want to hear from you. I mean, if you have some ideas of subjects that we should cover or something that's trending that you think that we need to respond to, please write to us at response@equip.org. And also, that's where we do letters to the editor now. I think I mentioned that a couple of times last year, but we no longer have a print issue. So letters to the editor, which is go to response@equip.org, and we do publish those. If you have a letter for us, and I'd say 250 words or less, we can put it at the end of an article in which you are writing a letter to the editor. So here's what we've got going on later this year. We are going to, this month, cover the new HBO series based on the Dune universe called Dune Prophecy. It's been a long time coming, but of course we need to finally cover the theology of Peter Enns. And also, you know, there's a lot that's been going on in the last decade or so just about personal trauma and really the increase of people going to therapy, both Christians and non-Christians. And so we're going to talk about traumas and therapy and Christianity later this spring. And also we have coming up the poetry of George Herbert and why that's important to the apologists. Now, as you know, we have covered when it came out, The Making of Biblical Womanhood, and now the follow-up from Beth Allison Barr of Baylor University is coming out. It's called Becoming the Pastor's Wife, How Marriage Replaced Ordination as a Woman's Path to Ministry, and we will be reviewing that book with Ann Kennedy, who also reviewed her other book. We have other apologetics articles, especially when we are thinking about Christian parents and their struggle with maybe their kids that are doubting their faith. So we have that coming up. And also, why is having a pastor at a church and church government biblical? We will be covering that as well. And of course, everything coming up, all the major tent poles, some of the things that we haven't covered ever, we will be dealing with this summer. That includes the final installment of the Mission Impossible series, Jurassic World and the Jurassic Film series. We've never covered DC. We've got DC Superman Legacy coming out, and it's been many years since we've dealt with Marvel. On our website, you will find an article called The Gospel According to Marvel, but that's quite a few years ago, and so we will be covering the Fantastic Four. We will return to the work of G.K. Chesterton and talk about his classic Orthodoxy, and so much more. So please get the word out. Especially the best way you can do that and get the word out to strangers is really rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Since I've said before, most people listen to all podcasts via Spotify and Apple. If you could just give us a starred review, but even better yet, take a few minutes of your time as a gift to us and write a one or two short sentence review about why you have this podcast in your podcast rotation. And you don't want to miss out on hearing the actual articles read, kind of like an audiobook, but an audio article on our newest podcast that debuted about a year ago. And that's called Christian Research Journal Reads. And you can get that wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Well, now back to my conversation with Melissa Kane Travis. All of that is very fascinating because, like you said, it's made its way into kind of popular culture, especially with all the things that focus on mindfulness and self-care and bringing in those Eastern views into just kind of how people could potentially cope with some of these things that they're facing. And I want to mention too to our listeners, and we will link them in the show notes, that a few years ago, you wrote an article for the Christian Research Journal on various famous scientific materialists and how they would respond to the meaning problem. So is this one, new one that you've done, is that related in any way?
Well, this article wasn't intended as a sequel per se, but the content is absolutely an expansion on the same themes from that article. So a moment ago, I mentioned Sean Carroll and Brian Greene and their books on finding meaning in a silent universe or a godless universe. And I unpacked that in that previous article. I interacted with their philosophy, which they refer to as either optimistic naturalism or poetic naturalism is what Sean Carroll likes to call it. So I definitely encourage listeners to find that article. It's entitled Scientific Materialist Manifesto, The Pursuit of Meaning in a Godless Universe. And read that in parallel with this new article because it will give you an even broader context for the conversation.
So in your article, you actually start out with a quote from Elon Musk, who has been in the news quite a bit lately. And it's a comment that he made, post that he made on X a couple of months ago about the necessity of interplanetary travel. So what did you find interesting about his comment and what does it have anything to do with the meaning crisis?
Yeah, in that post, Musk said that the long-term survival of conscious life depends upon achieving interplanetary travel. Now, I'm always fascinated with statements like this, especially from non-religious people. Not long ago, Musk described himself as a cultural Christian, and he's talked on and off about the sociological and cultural benefits of Christianity, but he still notes that he's not a religious person. It's interesting that historically he's been understood as either agnostic or atheist, so I'm not sure where exactly he is in his religious evolution, if you will. But anyway, what I find so striking about these kinds of comments, especially when they're made by celebrity futurists like Musk or Ray Kurzweil, for example, is that extending the existence of conscious life or of the human race may be technologically possible, but there is a hard limit. There will always be a hard limit because the universe itself is doomed. So humans may eventually escape the solar system before the sun incinerates planet Earth, but eventually entropy is going to win, full stop. Astrophysicists call this the heat death of the universe, which is when there will be no more usable energy anywhere. So if there's no such thing as an afterlife that's independent from the material world, which is what would make eternal existence possible for human persons, the question is, why does it matter if humanity lasts another century, a million more years, or if we only last one more day? Because if the end is the same, if the ultimate end for us as conscious creatures is eternal non-existence, then my question is, what's the point of all the effort and all the expense that we would need to go to just extend the existence of our race a little bit more or even a lot more? Because at the end, everything's going away. All things are going to end and no one will be around to remember any of this.
That is really fascinating. Now, what does that actually have to do with meaning? I mean, you mentioned the eventual death of the universe. What does that even relate to this particular topic, you know, practically for our listeners trying to get a handle on how to understand this whole trend?
Well, if the universe is temporally finite and naturalism is true, if both of those things are true, then any purpose or significance or value that we perceive or that we try to generate during our human lifetimes ultimately turns out to be meaningless. Once all things come to an end, we're not going to have any kind of enduring legacy. There won't be any memory, as I said, of conscious life having ever existed. So for any of this, any of our existence, the things that we do, the things that we love, our grand achievements, for any of that to matter at all, there has to be an ultimate hope, a transcendent source who bestows objective meaning upon our lives, who we will go on to enjoy forever, just to paraphrase the Westminster Catechism. So the way William Lane Craig puts it in his classic lecture, The Absurdity of Life Without God, is that there are two essentials for our lives to be objectively meaningful: God and eternity. And so that's what I'm getting at here. We have to have the transcendent, and there has to be hope for an eternal existence in communion with that transcendent source. And so when we talk about the eventual heat death of the universe, if that means that humans also face eternal non-existence, then that eliminates any chance for there being objective meaning of life. And if there is no God, nothing that transcends this material world, then we're also in the same boat. And according to the naturalist, we don't have either of those things. And so that's how the finitude of the universe relates to this philosophical problem of meaning.
So you've written before about
how some scientific materialists, like the ones you've mentioned so far in this podcast, including Brian Greene and Sean Carroll, and of course, most people might have heard of Neil deGrasse Tyson, how they try to escape the meaning problem. Are there any contemporary scientists who seem troubled by the impossibility of transcendent meaning within a naturalistic view of reality?
Oh, yes, for sure. So early last year, it was in April of last year, I was up in Dallas. I had a speaking engagement that was related to the total solar eclipse that we had last year. And while I was in between lectures, I was over at a Barnes & Noble bookstore just browsing around for some decompression time. And I was over in the science section and a particular book caught my eye. It was just this little paperback book entitled The End of Everything Astrophysically Speaking. And it was written by a scholar I'd never heard of, Dr. Katie Mack. And I discovered that Dr. Mack is an astrophysicist at UNC Chapel Hill. So I grabbed it off the shelf, went over and got a coffee and sat down to flip through it. And after I skimmed it, I figured, oh, this would probably be pretty valuable in my research on the intersection of science and the philosophy of meaning. So I bought a copy and it turned out that I was right. Most of the book is this introductory level explanation of the physics involved with the birth of the universe, its development, and then the two main scientific models that describe how the universe will end. But then you strike gold in the epilogue of this book because Katie Mack turns to this philosophizing about what all this says about human significance. And she's actually a wonderful writer, and I want to share this one excerpt with our listeners from her epilogue. She says, "It's impossible to seriously contemplate the end of the universe without ultimately coming to terms with what it means for humanity. There has to come a point in any timeline with a finite extent where our legacy as a species just stops. Whatever legacy-based rationalization we use to make peace with our own personal deaths, perhaps we leave behind children or great works or somehow make the world a better place, none of that can survive the ultimate destruction of all things. At some point, in a cosmic sense, it will not have mattered that we ever lived. The universe will, more likely than not, fade into a cold, dark, empty cosmos, and all that we've done will be utterly forgotten." And then Dr. Mack goes on and she gives these short excerpts of conversations that she's had with various scientific colleagues in her field, and their words are also incredibly revealing. So for example, she has this conversation with University of Cambridge astrophysicist Dr. Hiranya Paris about how Dr. Paris felt about the universe coming to an end. And Dr. Paris says, "It's very depressing. I don't know what else to say about it. I give talks where I mention that this is probably the fate of the universe, and people have cried." And I just thought that was so poignant. And then she gives another excerpt from a conversation that she had with a theoretical physicist at Princeton. And I had actually never heard of him before, but I'm now very glad that he's on my radar because I've been able to find some video interviews and so forth with him that are really fascinating. His name is Dr. Nima Arkani Hamed. And in his conversation with Katie Mack in her book, this is what he says. "At the absolute deepest level, whether or not people explicitly admit to thinking about it or not, and if they don't, they're all the poorer for it. If you think there is a purpose to life, then I at least don't know how to find one that doesn't connect to something that transcends our little mortality. I think a lot of people at some level, either explicitly or implicitly, will do science or art or something because of the sense that you get to transcend something. You touch something eternal. That word, eternal, very important. It's very, very, very important. So I looked up Dr. Arkani Hamed online, trying to get a sense for his religious views. And honestly, I could not make heads or tails out of the little clues that I found online. So I don't know where he is in terms of his religious beliefs, but I found it like utterly fascinating that he really harps on this idea that if we're going to find deep meaning and purpose, then we have to somehow connect to something transcendent and eternal. And that just reinforces what I was saying earlier and what William Lane Craig argues in his lecture, that those are the things we have to have if we're going to have objective meaning in life.
That is really fascinating, just those folks and what they're thinking about and the fact that it is depressing. I want to go back to your article, and you spend a good deal of the article unpacking this philosophical concept called the meaning triad. So can you please explain to our listeners what the meaning triad is?
Sure. So about a year ago, I discovered the work of a Notre Dame philosopher I had not heard of before, Dr. Joshua Sechrist. He co-authored a textbook with one of my favorite philosophers, Dr. Stuart Getz, and the book is entitled, What is This Thing Called the Meaning of Life? And the moment I discovered the book, I bought a copy because I knew that it was going to be a treasure trove for my research interests. So in the book, Sechrist and Getz discuss a construct called the meaning triad, and this includes three criteria that they argue are necessary for meaningfulness. And those criteria are intelligibility, purpose, and significance. Intelligibility refers to sense-making and the coherence of a worldview. So things make sense to us when they fit together appropriately, when there's a logical coherence within a unified whole. And Sechrist and Getz argue that when it comes to the search for life's meaning, what we're concerned with are existentially weighty matters, things like origins, purpose, significance, value, suffering, death, and our final destiny. So if our answers to questions about these kinds of things don't fit together in a coherent and satisfying way within our worldview framework, we are, as Sechrist and Getz put it, haunted by the specter of meaninglessness. And the second element is purpose. So purpose is somewhat self-explanatory. We structure our lives around this hierarchy of goals, if you will. We have some that are implicit, some that are explicit. And those who claim that we don't need God to have a meaningful life, like the scientific materialists we've already mentioned a couple times in this podcast, they often focus on this element of the triad. They say, well, we can create our own purposes, and that would include things like contributing to something bigger than ourselves. In other words, doing things that can improve the human condition for our fellow humans, whether it's in the present or future generations. And this is how some would distinguish between a life of selfish hedonistic pursuits and a life with a genuinely fulfilling purpose, at least in theory. And then the third part of the triad is significance. And that's also pretty self-explanatory. It's what somebody has in mind when they think of the idea of mattering, someone or something having importance and worth. So those are the three elements of the triad: intelligibility, purpose, and significance. And according to Getz and Sechrist, this triad is what's at least necessary. And I'm not going to say it's entirely sufficient, but we can say that this triad is at minimum necessary for there to be true meaningfulness in life.
So it seems like thinkers that we've mentioned already, Brian Greene, Sean Carroll, they are convinced that they can achieve this meaning triad without the existence of God. So how would somebody have a good philosophical response to that idea?
Oh, there's a lot that could be said about the philosophical problems that arise when it comes to achieving these elements of the triad within a naturalistic framework. And in that older article that I mentioned, I unpack that to a pretty good extent. But what Goetz and Seekers call this terrestrial framework actually excludes anything transcendent. And so that gives rise to a whole host of problems. First of all, naturalism has a severe intelligibility problem. And we see this pretty clearly when we examine the other two elements of the triad. So I'm going to try to explain that. So consider purpose, which is where we see much of the emphasis when we read guys like Greene, Carroll, and deGrasse Tyson. When it comes to cultivating a deeply satisfying life purpose by, for instance, living selflessly toward our fellow humans or working for the greater good, there's actually, on naturalism, there's no way to judge the moral value of doing such things. So when we call things like self-sacrifice, altruism, and the pursuit of justice good or admirable, that's actually completely arbitrary if there's no transcendent standard by which to judge. So all of those things essentially boil down to us doing things that induce pleasurable brain states. We really only do them because they make us feel good about ourselves. They make us feel proud about how we live our lives and proud of how other people see us. And then besides that, besides this being arbitrary and completely subjective, at the end of the day, what Seekers calls the specter of meaninglessness, that still looms. Because no matter how grand our humanitarian accomplishments are, they're ultimately pointless in light of the death of the universe. There'll be no one around to remember what we did or the collective legacy of humanity. And then finally, objective significance can't possibly exist if there's no transcendent creator who bestows it. So within the terrestrial framework, significance can never be anything but personal opinion. So we can step back and see then how naturalism is ultimately unintelligible because these existentially weighty things that we deeply long for, like objective purpose and significance, simply aren't attainable. Those longings are in direct conflict with naturalism. That's where we have this incoherence. And that means an overarching meaning of life can't be realized within this framework because of this lack of intelligibility. The best that we can do is create some kind of nebulous, imaginary form of meaning. And then in addition to the absence of the transcendent, we can also come back to the problem of the eventual demise of the universe. I like how Seekers puts it in a journal article that he wrote about the meaning problem. He says, human longings, especially along significance, value, and purpose axes, and deep hopes for a lasting place for love and felicity are stubborn. These Shalom-esque longings do not fit, or at least do so in a thinner form within a naturalistic universe. So I want to emphasize two things from that quote. He says, we long for and hope for a lasting place of love and felicity. And then he uses that wonderful term, Shalom-esque, this lasting place of peace and happiness and satisfaction. And a naturalistic framework simply can't provide those things. And Seekers is arguing, well, if we can't have that within the naturalistic framework, then it lacks intelligibility. And then the other two elements of the triad, as we've also seen, they fail to achieve intelligibility within the naturalistic framework. And so the ultimate judgment is, well, naturalism cannot give us an objective meaning of life, not in the sense that we really deeply long for.
It's interesting that in this article you discuss atheist philosopher Todd May, because a few years ago you wrote an article for us that was a review of the Netflix series The Good Place with Ted Danson. And what does philosopher Todd May have to say about the meaning problem? And by the way, please read her review about that, because it's a very fascinating TV series.
So Todd May is such an interesting guy to me. I own a few of his books. He's a professor of philosophy at Clemson University, and he was actually one of the philosophical consultants for the writers of that Netflix series, The Good Place. And back when I was writing that article, I spent some time reading one specific book of his, which focuses on the philosophical issues that surround the finitude of the universe and the finality of human death. So he has a book entitled Death, and then the one that I'm referring to is entitled A Significant Life, Human Meaning in a Silent Universe. And in that book, he says the following: "We would have preferred our humanity to be etched into the nature of things as an imprimatur that gives it and us significance. Barring that, we would at least have liked a little cosmic support, a god or a telos that assures us of meaningfulness of the years that we spend here. But things are not like that. The universe is silent. We are not anointed. We are not awaited. And we are not welcomed. We are cosmic accidents." So Todd May's solution for this predicament is for us to develop what he calls a life narrative. So he thinks that by conceiving of our lives as stories, stories that unfold over time, these dramas that have a beginning, a middle, and an end, then we can understand our lives as having a kind of meaning, and that helps soothe this existential angst that we have about the fact that the universe is eventually going to come to an end. But if you think about that, this conceiving of our lives as a story or a narrative, it's really far from clear, at least to me, how this accomplishes much of anything, how it could alleviate this undercurrent of cosmic emptiness that the naturalist has to cope with. We can construct these elaborate narratives to describe our lives, but the inevitability and finality of death really casts its shadow backwards. That's how I like to put it. Like it or not, the ending of any story, including real life stories, the ending of any story ultimately determines the meaning of the whole. And so this goes right back to that point that I've mentioned a couple times. We have to have the transcendent and we have to have eternity in order for there to be any objective meaning.
So this idea about narrative and the human search for meaning is something that you've written about elsewhere. So I want you to share some of that with us.
Yeah. So just briefly, I wrote a review for CRI, actually, on the first season of a sci-fi series on Apple TV called Foundation. It's an adaptation of an Isaac Asimov book series. So I reviewed the first season of the show. And what I found really interesting, that although Asimov was a very outspoken atheist, one of the themes in the Foundation story is that as human beings, we long to situate ourselves within a grand cosmic story. There's something intrinsic to our nature that just longs to understand all of reality, this grand existence, on the human level and on the cosmic level as one big story. And the reason we long for that is because there is indeed meaning in story. But again, you run into the problems of finitude and lack of the transcendent. And it's really interesting to me how in the Foundation series, they actually touch on this longing for the transcendent. Cleon goes on this religious pilgrimage at one point that is testament to this. And then just the whole theme of the Foundation series as a whole is very much this need for understanding ourselves within a story. And ultimately, Christianity provides that for us. We understand the beginning, the middle, the end, and then our grand hope for an eternal future of the story. And naturalism doesn't provide that for us. I just as a side note, I am so interested in how we see these kinds of themes, particularly in science fiction film and science fiction literature. That's another project I hope to work on a lot more in future years.
And it's really interesting too, because I don't know that as we talk to folks that are not religious who are very convinced of this naturalist worldview, that they really thought through the logical conclusions of some of their views. And you point out that human evil and suffering is very problematic to the person who has this naturalist worldview when it comes to them trying to pursue and create meaning in life. So why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about how they would even refute that and why that is problematic? Because I don't know if we really think through some of the conclusions of some people who just, oh, okay, I'm going to dismiss all religion and this is my view.
Yeah, yeah. So when it comes to the problem of evil and suffering, within Christian apologetics, we like to tackle that from the point of view of there being a bigger problem of evil and suffering for the naturalist. But there's another side to this. There's even more of a problem. When we face the inevitability of suffering and the inevitability of death, whether it's the death of somebody we dearly love, or when we're facing our own impending death, deep down, we don't want these things to be utterly senseless. We want them to have meaning that's fully realized when they're redeemed, when they're ultimately made right. And Christianity provides this. We do have to live with a lot of mystery in this life when it comes to why there is the amount of suffering there is. But we're promised that all things will eventually be made right. At the end of this earthly existence, it will all be redeemed, and God will reveal to us how all the things in this life, even the worst of human suffering, worked together for the good of those who love him. And so the naturalist is just stuck with the realities of horrible suffering and with the reality and finality of death. But it for them, it's just absurdity, to use the word that I used early in the podcast. It's just senseless. But for the Christian, we have this wonderful hope for all things to be resolved. And that's why I think that this is really a problem for the naturalist when it comes to the holistic project of meaning in life. You know, they can take on all of these projects to fabricate purpose in their lives or to cultivate a sense of significance in some way or another, but they cannot make sense of suffering and death.
So this is an issue that you have, you know, an interest in, a scholarly interest. And so I knew you're working on some future projects. So can you explain some of those and what we can look for from you in the future on this?
So I have a co-authored book that's coming out in February of 2026. The title of that book is The Reconstruction Project, and my co-author is Dr. Andrew Ike Shepherdson. And one of the chapters that I wrote for the book is on the meaning problem, and some of the material from this article is actually adapted from that chapter. But for the remainder of this year, my plan is to continue researching for a solo publication on this topic. I don't know yet what form it'll take. I need to really be immersed in this topic for a good while before I figure that out. But I'm thinking it'll probably turn into a full-length book at the least. It's like the longer I research it, the more I realize how much else there is to learn on the problem of meaning. So this is probably going to be something that I spend many more years on.
Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast today to start the conversation on this very important topic. And it's kind of always a tradition to ask a fun question. And so my question to Melissa is, we're a little past January now, but I want to know from you, if you look back at the end of the year, what is a word that you hope will be describing 2025 for you?
Oh, that's interesting. I don't have one word, but I do have a phrase that has just been echoing in my mind, even still after the New Year's a good several weeks behind us. And that is turning of the tide. And I actually feel like this is a phrase that the Lord gave me when I was in prayer at my church one day back in maybe November, I think. And it just keeps echoing, as I said. But turning of the tide is my phrase for 2025.
Well, that's really interesting. Thank you for sharing that with us. And thank you for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast. And we are hoping to have Melissa back again sometime this year.
Thanks, Melanie. This was great.
You've been listening to episode 435 of the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Dr. Melissa Kane Travis, and she has written an online exclusive feature article for the Christian Research Journal called The Pathos of the Reflective Naturalist, Meaning, Happiness, and Eternity in Our Hearts. And you can read her article for free at equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Handegraff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.